are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, December 13th, 2016. My name is Michael Brooks, pinch hitting partially for Sam Steeder today, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, an interview that Sam did last week with Mara Einstein, call on her new book, Black Ops Advertising, about how native advertising is corrupting journalism, distorting how we receive information. It's all part of this brave new world of branded content, fake news, and distilling what is real, what is false, what's an ad, what's reporting, what content is in this brave new world. Brand new interview he did with her. And I take over on the fun half. We're talking about Rex Tillerson, a man who's run a private foreign policy for Exxon, taking his experience and his value set, which is wiring the world up for hydrocarbons, to the State Department in the Trump era. Bernie Sanders at a town hall converting Trump supporters, but maybe actually showing some problematic tendencies himself. We'll get to that. And Russia's hydrocarbon connection, plus your calls and IMs, all that and more on the fun half of today's Majority Report after the great interview that Sam did with Mara Einstein. Speaking of wiring the world for hydrocarbons, one thing about Rex Tillerson, CEO of Exxon, and I'm fascinated by Exxon as a company. I read Steve Cole's indispensable book, Exxon Private Empire, a couple years ago. I'm going to see if I can get him on as a guest. That book and Ghost Wars are really the sort of two of the prime books for basically understanding the world we're in from a global perspective, a corporate power perspective, a terrorism perspective, and a South Asian and Middle East perspective. He's really indispensable. But the thing I will say about Rex Tillerson is that whatever else you think of him, he has a high degree of intelligence and competence. So there will be a ruthless efficiency to turning the United States over even more fully to a foreign policy based on pure, almost neo-mercantile resource extraction, which it already is in many ways. But over the Department of Energy, Donald Trump is leaning towards a guy, I think actually the offer has been made, who maybe displays a little bit less of a sort of shrewd ruthlessness that you would get from Rex Tillerson. And of course, I'm talking about Governor Rick Perry, the guy who makes George W. Bush look like a neurosurgeon. And I say neurosurgeon specifically because I would say he still doesn't make George W. Bush look that smart, but smart enough. Now, this is the famous moment back from 2012 where Rick Perry was in a Republican presidential debate and he wanted to scrap three departments, including the one he's apparently going to head. And he had this little moment. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you the next Secretary of Energy.
You work with Democrats or can you work with Republicans? Yeah, we can all do that. But the fact of the matter is we better have a plan in place that Americans can get their hands around. And that's the reason my flat tax is the only one of all the folks, these good folks on the stage. It balances the budget in 2020. It does the things to the regulatory climate that has to happen. And I will tell you, it's three agencies of government when I get there that are gone. Commerce, education, and the, what's the third one there? Let's see.
You need five.
Oh, five. Yeah, okay. So five. Commerce, education, and
EPA?
EPA. There you go. No, okay.
Let's talk deposition.
Seriously? Is EPA the one you were talking about?
No, sir. We were talking about the agencies of government. EPA needs to be rebuilt.
But
there's
you
no doubt about
but
that.
But you can't name the third one?
The third agency of government. Yeah. I would do away with the education, commerce, and let's see. I can't. The third. Sorry. Oops.
What about the EPA and
Oops. Great. Next guy in charge of the Energy Department. I want to talk to you about Framebridge. Framebridge is a service that is really, really helpful if you need to basically sync the photos you have and images you have with building out your room and your art space, basically. And it's an incredible site. I am in the process of using it right now. What it does is it allows you to choose your frame or let designers help you choose. What you do is you upload a photo from your computer or directly from Instagram. You preview your photo online in a frame options that they have, and then you choose. If you can't upload your art or your photo or art, no worries. You can mail it to them for free. It's a framing service. And instead of the hundreds you pay at the framing store, their prices start at $39 and all shipping is free. So now it's like, what is it, Matt? No, go ahead.
Well, I've just got to say I'm interested in this because I am sort of transitioning from I'm still in the same apartment I was in when I was a grad student.
Right.
And I didn't really care a lot about decorating the walls a whole lot while in that phase, but I'm trying to transition out of that and sort of evolve into a more full adult.
Now you're like,
and
I have a lot of pictures of Nixon I'd like to look
exactly.
at.
Exactly. Yeah, and I literally do have an unframed Nixon poster. I
have not visited Matt. That is just a deduction from his disturbed personality.
But yeah, I was actually thinking I need a service like this. So.
So it's a great service. And then it allows you also to sync up whatever you want. So maybe you have a picture on your phone of you and your family, you and friends, or you have, you know, a picture of Richard Nixon as an example. You can choose.
Maybe
anything.
You have a picture of Melvin Laird that you ran through an Instagram filter.
Maybe you. I would actually say it's a safe bet that you do. Framebridge has a frame for every style, from clean and classic to more eclectic. Framebridge uses premium real wood moldings, acid-free mat board, and a foam board in there. Acrylic glazing will never shatter and protects your piece from harmful UV rays. And the expert team at Framebridge will custom your frame item in days, not weeks or months, and deliver you a finished piece directly to your door, ready to hang. Framebridge offers a happiness guarantee. Their team gives each item personal care and attention because meeting your expectations is as important as meeting their own. Get started today. Go to framebridge.com. Use promo code MAJORITY. There's a link to it on the website. And you'll save an additional 15% off of the first order. Just go to Framebridge, FRAMEBRIDGE.com. Use promo code MAJORITY. Framebridge.com, promo code MAJORITY. And part of being an adult is shaving, theoretically. I've been back on a shaving tip. I have to figure out what the winter game plan is here. But we all know that if you shave any part of your body, Harry's is the answer. It's our old pal, Harry's. I think it's a great gift idea. I actually am going to be sending Harry's to a couple of people that I have on my list. And it's just like, there's this phrase I like called the elusive obvious. There's some people that it's just like impossible to shop for. You just don't know what to get them. And short of doing like a Donnie Brasco mafia style, just like give them some money in an envelope, which is my preferred gift, frankly, if I'm not going to get a Harry's, just give me cash. I will send them Harry's. Problem solved. Luckily, I don't have to deal with any brothers-in-laws yet, but now I know. Even before I have them, I already know what I'll get them. Harry's. What I love most about shaving with Harry's is it's close, it's smooth, and I have sensitive skin. It works with my skin. It doesn't agitate me at all. The foams, the bumps, I do. The poor snowflake. Snowflake, It's perfect for, and but then I also, you know, it gets the job done with thick beards as well.
I can grow it out. Yep.
Like an actual beard.
Well, I don't go that far, but
well, you can't.
I'm gonna give it as a gift to my brother-in-law.
I know you were mentioning. Even though he said he has a wizard beard that he
needs
to take
I know
care of.
It's gonna aggravate the wizard beard issue, but you know what? I don't care. It's more important.
Harry's is not only a great gift; it's a great hint. So Harry's. So it's practical. It's beautiful. It comes in a great box. It comes with all of the accoutrements of a great shaving experience. It's like a little, like, old school, like, I remember in Turkey, I actually did this a couple times, and normally it makes me feel super uncomfortable to have someone, like, actually razoring my face. But it is, like, a cool, like, kind of old school barbershop experience. You get it in this incredibly nice box. The foam, the aftershave balm soothes your skin. And if you, and look, if you haven't heard of them before, which is crazy, why would you? Why wouldn't you have? Harry's was started by two Harry's and hashtag 39s was started by two best friends, Jeff and Andy, who were fed up with being overcharged for razors. Yeah, no kidding. So they started their own razor company to give people what they deserve, a great shave at a fair price. This holidays, Harry's has a ready to gift shave sets for all different price points starting at just $15. All come with a razor handle of your choice, shaving cream, replacement blades, and a travel cover. Their Winston set includes an engraved chrome handle if you want to add a personalized touch. ML, I know Matt's already on it. It's just like, would you get a one for yourself engraved or like one for Richard Milhouse Nixon?
I don't think I'd get one for Nixon.
Okay, good. Yeah, I'm glad that there are some limits to this. Ground shipping for the holidays ends on December 16th, so act now. You only got a couple of days to get the perfect obvious gift. Go to harrys.com right now and get a holiday shave set. And don't forget to enter code MAJORITYREPORT at checkout for $5 off. That's harrys.com, code MAJORITYREPORT. Get $5 off. We love Harry's. It's the best way to shave, without a doubt. We will be right back with Sam's interview with Mara Einstein on the Majority Report. See you on the fun half.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Mara Einstein, she is the author of Black Ops Advertising, released by OR Books, and she is also a professor of media studies at Queen College, City University of New York. Mara, thanks so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So what exactly is Black Ops Advertising?
Well, the easiest way to talk about it, and people seem to be a little bit confused about the name, ops is operations, right? So in the same way that we think of covert military actions as black ops, this is covert marketing or stealth marketing. And the reason why I came up with the name is that when we talk about advertising and marketing, those of us who have worked in the industry, we talk about it in terms of objectives and strategies and tactics, which is very militaristic. And in fact, the audience is the target. So in the same way, the military has moved from being a more covert, direct interaction with people and has become more covert, the same thing's happening with advertising. And this, what's going on now and has really taken off in the online space, but is now also occurring in television and print as well, is this idea of native advertising and content marketing. And native advertising is advertising that has been created to be indigenous to the site within which it appears. So most people are probably familiar with that in terms of ads that appear in their news feeds on Facebook or Twitter, or even celebrity spokespeople hawking for different products on Instagram. The other place that we see that is on someplace like BuzzFeed, and BuzzFeed creates the listicles, right? You know, what Fraggle Rock character are you?
Right.
And then it turns out to be an ad for something. What are the 10 things that have changed over the last 20 years? And it turns out to be an ad for a cell phone. So those are the kinds of things that people engage with because they're funny and they're cute, and then 2 or 3 minutes in, find out they've actually spent time with an ad. The other place that we see this is, and this is called custom native advertising, is on traditional journalism sites like the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, and they look like traditional articles, and they will have a headline, they'll have a byline, there'll be a picture and text that looks like an article, but in fact have been paid for by an advertiser.
Now, the one of the most prominent of these, or maybe it's just most prominent for me because of the sort of the space I operate in, was the 2013 Atlantic doing a now was this this qualify as native advertising in this way, the story about the Church of Scientology?
Church of Scientology, yeah.
Tell that story for people who don't recall it.
Yeah. So what happened is that the Atlantic did a story about the Church of Scientology and had a picture of David Miscavige, who was the head of the church, and it had a line about how the church had been growing and so on and so forth. And the issue with this, and what people who work in the industry will say, is that there was a box with a yellow box that said sponsored on it. So there were some indications that this was, in fact, something that was paid for. But you get to start reading this quote-unquote article, and it's very effusive about how wonderful the church is and how great David Miscavige is. And people went pretty ballistic, actually, yes, about this content, because it was really saying such wonderful things about the church, and everybody was like, how could the Atlantic be saying this? But the other really sort of sneaky thing that happened with this is that because this was under the auspices of the marketing department and not under the editorial department, was that they were keeping an eye on what the comments were in response to this article, and anything that was negative was pulled off because the marketing department was pulling off all of the negative comments. And people who were trying to comment and say things that were not positive about it didn't get through. Eventually, some of them did. But initially, that wasn't happening. And by less than 12 hours later, this was pulled off the site. They said, you know, we made a mistake. We're trying to learn about how to do this new native advertising thing, and we obviously have to go back to the drawing board and figure it out. But what was interesting to me was, when I was doing the research for the book, was to ask people, can you come up with an example of really bad native advertising? And this is a couple of years afterwards. And really the only bad example people could come up with was this Church of Scientology example in the Atlantic. And I began to think, well, why? Why is that the only one? And I think most of it has to do with the fact that they're not aware of it, and marketers have gotten really good at it. They've gotten really good at figuring out how to create content that marries into the publication itself, and to find that balance between what starts to look like we're being too nice to this particular advertiser.
So in other words, it's how do we make it seamless?
Exactly. Exactly. That's exactly right. And some of the stuff is kind of innocuous, right? So if it's Orange is the New Black paying for an article about women in prison, and that might not have been a topic that would have been covered by the New York Times, okay, I don't think that in and of itself people might be particularly offended about. But the Church of Scientology, obviously people would be offended about, but something like Shell Oil paying for a piece about sustainability and environmentalism and us not knowing that Shell is behind it, that's when we start to get into some really fuzzy kind of ethics.
So, you know, so when you're talking about native advertising, and the other one was the content, sponsored?
Content marketing.
Content marketing. Where uh-huh. What is the line that delineates those? So the listicles would be the content marketing, and the native advertising would be a sort of almost semi-seamless, almost editorial voice that is actually presenting something that's paid.
Well, both of those are native advertising. Content marketing is a little bit different. And what content marketing is information or entertainment that has been created by the advertiser and then gets disseminated through social media. And specifically, the content marketing doesn't have a sales pitch attached to it. And this is what makes it really interesting, is that advertisers are trying to present themselves as authority on a particular topic and say to consumers, come, we'll give you information about, you know, sleep, or we'll give you information about the environment, or we'll give you information about the best foods to eat. And then when you're ready to buy, then you'll come buy our product. But in the initial contact and in the initial creation of the content, there isn't any kind of sales pitch in there. And that, you know, and so it, one of the things I heard, which was really interesting too, was that marketers constantly said, Social is for social, it's not for selling. And what they meant by that was that they would interact with consumers in the social space on Facebook and Twitter to become their friends, but not to provide a sales pitch there.
They call that becoming a trust agent, right? And you can see this is not you know, even corporate. I mean, if you can see this with Steve Jones, the plumber, mm-hmm. and he's doing how-tos or something like that mm-hmm. on mm-hmm. YouTube, and mm-hmm. ultimately you go to that outfit to buy it. So, I mean, from your perspective, in terms of how new is this to mm-hmm. the internet? Because and how unique is it? Because when I hear of stuff, particularly like native advertising, in particular, it doesn't seem terribly different from where we've been in terms of product placement in films, mm-hmm. and even mm-hmm. you used to work at NBC. I know that, for instance, when Conan O'Brien was at NBC, and I presume they did for other shows. I just happen to have knowledge of this, that they would make deals with, I don't know. I mean, I'm just pulling this, just using this arbitrarily, but with Microsoft, and they're going to go on the road with the Conan O'Brien show, and they're in Seattle. They're going to go by the Microsoft campus, and they're going to check mm-hmm. out all the neat stuff. But that's mm-hmm. actually a paid, you know, sort of a I guess instead of paying a location fee, they're getting paid to come to that location.
Right. That's exactly right. The difference between, I mean, I think by now most people are pretty well aware of product placement. That's not anything new. And in fact, you know, product placement has, you know, really been around for over 100 years. It was in film in the late 1800s, but really took off at the time of like Survivor, right? And because what happened with Mark Burnett is Mark Burnett went to CBS and said, you know, I have this show, it doesn't have a script, people are put on an island, and CBS was like, you know, we can't get an audience for our scripted stuff, we're not going to pay you for that. They said, you know, if you can find an advertiser that'll go behind it, then we'll pick up the show. And so that's what he did. And so that show,
they started giving away a car on every episode. Is basically they would bring out a car midway through, I think, and give it to one of the contestants, if I remember.
Right. Or what they would do, which is really great, you know, you're on an island for, you know, however many days, 30 days or whatever it is, and they bring out a basket with mouthwash and toothpaste, you know, and if you haven't brushed your teeth in a week, that's going to look really good to you, right? And so they could really, really on purpose make it look like this is something that they really wanted. But the difference between product placement and something like native advertising content marketing is that it is really not labeled as such, and it's really hard to understand when an advertiser is not attached to the content that's being produced. And so you can see a Coca-Cola can on the table and say, oh, okay, I see the Coca-Cola can. But if you are reading, I don't know, if you're reading an article about Goldman Sachs, or the recession, and then don't know that Goldman Sachs is behind it, I think that's a very different kind of thing. And you're also talking the difference between journalism and entertainment.
That was
and
the
I
next,
think there's a port in line.
That was the question, is that the does this obviously becomes more problematic based upon how the, I guess, the consumer of the initial product, the mm-hmm. what their relationship is and what their expectations of what they're getting is, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
I don't...
Yeah, because we approach it differently, right? When we interact with entertainment, we sit back, we relax, we sort of take it in. And it's also the difference between when we interact with advertising versus when we interact with editorial, which is that when we know that something is advertising, our critical factors come in right away, right? And we start to think, oh, I know that there's somebody behind this. I know that, that somebody has a bias here and wants me to think a particular way about this content. We don't do that when we're reading an article in the newspaper or reading an article online. We think that it's going to be, you know, something that's been written for us by the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal and their reporters.
So what happens when we get awareness of this? And so, I mean, so the other element, I guess, is different is that notion of the imprimatur that that the presence of this is giving. I mean, on my on this show, I will do live reads of our sponsors' products, and you know, for me, it's I try and keep products that I actually will use and can use, and if I don't, then I don't feel comfortable doing it. But it's just a shaver, and it's pretty clear that I'm doing an ad as I talk about it, how it's integrated. But within the context of these, you know, for the Atlantic to give its imprimatur to a to the Scientologists, it is, I mean, theoretically, right, they're lending some of their credibility, even just in the by A, accepting their ad dollars, but more importantly, B, by be willing to shave down the and sometimes literal line between the advertisement and the content. What does that do to our perspective on the journalism, or does it impact our perspective on the product, or does it degrade one and enhance the other?
Well, that's a really excellent question. It certainly degrades the journalism, absolutely, because I mean, because really, what we're talking about is fake news. When you're talking about black ops advertising, you're talking about fake news. Now, it's not fake news that got sent over from Macedonia, but you are talking about the fact that, you know, we used to talk about the separation between church and state. And when I worked in advertising many years ago, I would go in for a client and I would go talk to a publication and say, you know, can't you put my client's product into this particular magazine piece? And the editors would look at me like I had three heads. They're like, no, this is our content. You can't muck it up with your client's product, and that's it. Now all bets are off as far as that goes. And so there's, you know, some in the, and this I'll say too, it's not just happening in the digital space. It's happening certainly in print, because there's certain clues that we looked for that told us that something was advertising. So if we were looking at a print ad, there would be a big picture, there would be a headline, there might be a picture of the product in the corner, and then a tagline. And that said to us, okay, I'm looking at an ad. But now you can look at a lot of magazines, and the things that are advertisements look exactly like something that is editorial. And so what begins to happen is that you begin to question everything, right? Is this really an ad that I'm reading? Or is this really a piece of unbiased journalism? And it becomes harder and harder to tell. You know, part of the reason why I wrote the book was to let people know where to look for the indicators that would tell them that this, in fact, was native advertising or content marketing. And the conversations that I had with people who work in the industry was, oh, people know. People know that this is advertising, you know, and they would look like they were about to pat me on the head when they said that. But in fact, there's more and more research that is coming out. There was a research that came out last year that said that only about 8% of people are able to tell when they are reading native advertising. And there was another piece of research that just came out last month from Stanford saying that middle school students, more than 60% of them were not able to tell that they were interacting with advertising.
All right. Well, let me that brings up a couple of things, and let me put a pin in the middle school assessment of dealing with advertisement. But do you think that that is necessarily the only problem? In other words, even if I, as a consumer, realize like, hey, this Scientology thing, and I keep using this because, mm-hmm. you know, it's just...
It's very obvious.
It's a very obvious one, and in real time, in the spaces that I work with, it was the most sort of notorious. But mm-hmm. even my awareness, even if I do realize this is advertising, but I am fully conscious by being able to look at the page that, like, it's integrated in a way that is... there's been more effort to integrate this. Does that then demean my relationship with the journalistic outlet by the fact that I realize it's advertising?
Yeah.
I mean that's and is that in some ways is that even more problematic, because if I start to believe, and not just I but just generally we as society believe that the journalism and I think, you know, rightfully so, we believe this maybe that this is really so driven by money that they're willing to, you know, soften the edges between yep. what they're getting paid yep. for and what their theoretically their core mission is, then I no longer have trust in the institution, largely speaking, and then everything gets reduced to this sort of same, somebody's trying to sell me something, mm-hmm. whether it's ideological or for money.
Yeah, yeah. If we pull this out to its obvious conclusion, I think that you're not far off in describing what would happen. And the fact of the matter is that the New York Times, they have a separate group that they call the T-Brand Studio, which is not included in the newsroom, but certainly works by the newsroom. Other publications have come out and flat out said that our reporters are creating the advertising content. So Condé Nast, for example, doesn't even hide the fact that their reporters are also creating the marketing content for the advertisers who come to them. And the argument that they make is along the lines of, well, people read Vogue for the advertising as much as they read Vogue for the content. So what is beginning to happen is more and more publications are starting to work under that same idea. But also bear in mind that the same thing is happening on the flip side in marketing companies. So there are some marketing departments that are starting to call the marketing departments newsrooms. So get the grasp of that, right? So instead of being the organization that's creating advertising, they're calling themselves newsrooms, and they're creating this information. And the argument that they're making is, well, who knows about this industry and this product better than we do, because we're working in it all the time. That's the kind of thing that I was hearing from these companies. So yes, you know, what it becomes incumbent upon us is to find journalists who we trust and we believe in and are hoping are somehow working within the system without getting caught up in some of the advertising. How that happens, I'm not completely convinced that I know. The one bright note I will say, because I hate being totally Debbie
Doon. I want to put a pin in that too. I want to get back to
okay.
Because if you're even remotely convinced that you know, I'm interested in how you deal with that. But I want to get back because I want to talk solution, or to the extent that there's even sort of a theoretical or an idea of what a theoretical solution could be. I want to just touch on that middle school assessment, because mm-hmm. Having a middle school child myself and a younger one, they are completely mystified by commercials, because, you know, unlike I, who when I was their age would watch a lot of television and the ads were completely discreet, I had no from the programming, or at least to a large extent, I should say, discreet from the programming. Mm-hmm. I couldn't fast forward through it or whatnot. You know, these guys watch what I called television in a very different way. They don't even refer to it as television, really. They refer to it as episodes because they can watch multiple, you know, they're not watching the television. They're watching the content, which they can see in various platforms, but they never see ads. And so, my daughter listens to Spotify. When we go into the car and we're turning, you know, we turn on a radio and she hears the radio playing, and then all of a sudden it's interrupted by these people who are doing God knows what. She's like, "What's going on here?" And so, mm-hmm. have they lost the ability to sort of recognize ads? How much does that play into this too?
Well, the place where I see that as being most disturbing is, and I find her disturbing anyway, is Kim Kardashian, right? And there was an article on the front cover of the New York Times, I don't know, a couple of months ago it is at this point, about how she goes onto Instagram and promotes a particular pill, or she did some pharmaceutical when she was pregnant, and says, oh, you know, when I take this vitamin, it's really great for my hair or whatever it is. And so the FTC finally took her to task and said, you know, you have to let people know that you're being paid for this. Because when she's being paid $75,000 to hawk an item, that's advertising. So what they're using now is this thing, hashtag ad, as if people know that that's the designator, that this is some form of advertising. Why that bothers me so much in terms of her is that, you know, she has a very large following of young girls. And so they are less likely to look at it and think, oh, she's trying to sell me something, above and beyond the fact that she's always trying to sell them something, right? So that's one part of it. I think the other part of it is, and my daughter's slightly older, she's 17, you know, I've been telling her since she was little that advertising lies. And I think that's probably the best thing we could do with our kids, is let them come at it with a really critical mindset. But I think to your point about, have the kids lost their ability to be able to differentiate between what is advertising and what is editorial content? Yes, and that's part of the reason why media literacy has become so much more important than it ever was before. But I also don't want to put this all on the and I hate calling people consumers all the time.
Right,
I don't want
right,
to put this
right,
on the
right.
back of people. I don't want to put this on the back of people. I don't want to put this on the back of kids. You know, the FTC needs to get involved. We need to get lawyers and privacy advocates involved and thinking, and because there's a whole big data portion of this we haven't even talked
right.
about, that needs to get involved in thinking in terms of, you know, how do we make sure that these are properly labeled so people know that they're interacting with consumer commercial content, and how is our information not constantly being tracked and used in support of advertisers?
The latter one, I mean, I think we've touched on in this program in a myriad of different ways. I mean, I was just reading a piece that via Facebook, you know, and it is the case, I guess it's best described as we are now the product in many respects in terms of the data collected. And the Trump campaign, I'm sure the Clinton campaign did their version of this. But the Trump campaign targeted specific groups, potential voters, to suppress their vote online with the campaign that, you know, the data is all supplied to them by Facebook. But broadly speaking, I mean, and I agree with you, you know, the term consumer is, you know, I guess we should be interacting with our journalism as citizens. And that's part of the problem, is that we are more and more interacting with it as consumers. Is the lack of awareness of that, I mean, what is specifically problematic about the lack of awareness of that? I mean, as opposed to, I mean, what do we get? I mean, I don't, you know, obviously I want to know when I'm being sold something, but what are the problems that can arise from that? Is it just, is it ultimately a problem of our citizenry?
But the problem is that marketers are like magicians. And what they do is they show you something sparkly in the left hand so you won't look at what's going on in the right hand. And so if I'm, you know, and I don't mean to hit on Shell Oil because it could be, you know, any one of the companies, whatever, you know, if I want to show you that I'm making these beautiful wind turbines in order to be able to create some kind of environmentally friendly energy, that's all really nice. But then who's going out and finding the information about the fact that right next to those windmills, they're pulling out oil from the ground and ruining the environment in another different way. Another example, a great example I can give you is Purina. Purina's done a great job online. They've done an unbelievable job. And one of the things that they do better than anybody else is they interact with people in real time on social media. They know when people's dogs have had a surgery. They know when somebody's taken a picture of their dog, and then they interact with them immediately. Well, at the same point that all of that stuff was going on, their dog food was being was allegedly killing dogs around the world. So, you know, again, while advertisers are showing you really nice, wonderful things that they're doing, caring about their consumers, they're not the ones that are going to tell you the fact that there's problems with their product. And the same thing is true with, makeup and the poisons that can be in makeup and selling that to young girls and all kinds of things.
All right, so let's talk about potential solutions, because I mean, it seems to me that the with media consolidation as it is, and for me, the biggest problem is that I think, you know, we're seeing manifested at least at this moment, and then I think we're going to see more in the era of the Trump presidency is. Less and less sort of, I guess, faith by citizens in various institutions and journalism being the most journalistic ones being the most prominent. Less and less faith and less reliance upon them as bellwethers or watersheds for what is true and legitimate or sound. And so If trying to maintain the integrity of these institutions while also keeping them economically viable is the real challenge, is that the real challenge? And B, what are the sort of what are the possible solutions?
Okay. Well, there's two things that are going that I would say about this. One is, while I was working on the book, what I was seeing was that for the first time, there was more money going into digital advertising than was going into legacy media, specifically television. And most of that money goes to Facebook and Google, two organizations that make absolutely no content. And so I think, you know, part of the thing that I wanted to come out about this is to really say loud, look, if we're not willing to support the institutions that are creating content that we like to see, like the broadcast networks and so on, we're going to have to start paying for it out of our own pocket. Well, that's fine for people who can afford to pay for HBO separately and Showtime separately and maybe CBS Access or whatever the OTTs they're all going to pay for, but it's going to start to get really expensive to have your own content. What we're starting to see is that some of the money is starting to go back into so-called legacy media, and so maybe some of the bloom is starting to be off the rose in terms of this kind of marketing, and we'll see. I don't have a crystal ball. I can't say. But the other thing that I've been thinking about a lot, particularly in the last couple of weeks, given everything that's gone on, and particularly in terms of fake news and so on, is if you remember the broadcast networks in the 1980s, the news divisions were sacrosanct. Right. They were not profit centers. They didn't have to make money. Walter Cronkite did what he did, and Huntley Brinkley and all those guys, it was about serving the public interest. And it wasn't until the 1980s, in the time of Reagan, that all of a sudden the corporate structures began to change and people like Tisch bought up CBS, and suddenly they said, no, these have to be profit centers and you guys got to start to make money. And the way you start making money is to start to cut as much as you possibly can. And so the first thing to go were things like international news divisions, and then you start to see, even at that point, you know, video news releases, which are basically video versions of a press release, appearing in more and more certainly local news. So if we could get to the point where, and this could actually be a point of difference for the broadcast networks, and they're not making money on their nightly news anyway. I'm telling you, when I worked there at NBC, they weren't making money on it then. I doubt they're making any money on it now. Mm. So just get rid of any of your advertising and your nightly news. Make it so those don't have to be profit centers anymore, and let them report, do the good kind of solid reporting that they used to do. And that could actually be something that would make them stand out and stand apart.
But who's going to do that? I mean, you're suggesting from a broadcast perspective for mm-hmm. ABC, NBC, and CBS, there is actually marketing value for them to return to the days where where they could say, you know, you can trust us because of our news division.
Yeah.
And that is sort of a lost leader for them and, and supporting the rest of, and then theoretically that, I mean,
that may be pie in the sky, but that's a theory I'm working with.
Okay. All right. I mean, fair enough. I mean, I'm just thinking of, you know, of Jeff Zucker, who's sitting on $1 billion that he didn't anticipate getting because of, basically that network's relationship with Donald Trump in some way.
Right.
And
don't even get me started on it.
Well, I mean, that's the problem. I mean, isn't it on some level that, I mean, I think,
But that's a cable network and that's different. And that is the only thing that he's doing. The only thing he's doing is all day long is having to fill a pipeline. So if you said to, and the broadcast networks aren't dependent on the money that they make from their news division, now, particularly not in terms of their nightly news. I mean, look at their nightly news. Who's advertising on there? You know, a couple of pharmaceutical companies and maybe Centrum Silver, you know, but if they could produce a really good, solid half hour of unbiased news content that then they could push out through social media or whatever they want to do during the rest of the day, but use that as a unique selling proposition to say, we're the people that you can trust because we're, you know, we do not let the rooster into the hen house in terms of letting advertisers anywhere near this content. That could be a really solid thing for them to be able to do. And we as citizens could say to them, look, this is part of you serving the public interest.
Right. I mean, there was, I think it's probably still on the books. If not, the FCC certainly doesn't perceive, is it not enforcing that notion that to get a broadcast license, you have to have a certain mm-hmm. amount of, I don't even see those ads anymore of where, you know, if you have a problem with this station getting a license, send it in to us. So, but where else? Is there any other potential solutions you're looking at?
You know what? It was one of the hardest books I had to write because I didn't have a whole lot of solutions.
I know.
I really don't. And
that's
I would
going
love
around
hear.
These days, for a lot of our problems, I think, particularly at the moment. But, I mean, I guess to a certain extent, it's going to start with awareness. I'm not convinced, and maybe I'm biased here, but the freemium model that we work on, we still take ads, but they are, we can be a lot pickier, frankly, with the ads mm-hmm. that we're willing to take.
Part of it is that people have said to me, well, why don't people complain about this? And I said, part of the issue is people don't know it exists. So I think the more we can get the word out to say, this is what's going on in your media space, and more of the content you're interacting with has a corporate bias behind it, and so you need to be aware of it. We can get more people aware of it, not just for their own protection, but then to say, look, something's got to get done. And, you know, just in the same way, you cannot tell me that Zuckerberg couldn't have done something in terms of cutting off the advertising support for the fake news. You know, with all of their abilities to be able to track us and play around with the algorithms and all those sorts of things, he could have made sure that those sites didn't have access to the ad networks. And I refuse to believe that he didn't know that he could do that.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. Mara Einstein, the book is Black Ops Advertising. We'll put a link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Had a great time. Thanks so much.
Okay, welcome back to the Majority Report. Very disturbing stuff there. Let's see. And I also just wanted, I didn't top note it, but obviously there's also a complete meltdown in Aleppo, which we will circle back to as well. It's horrific. The number is 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. I'm already on, so if you want to join me. And remember, if you're watching on YouTube, take it down if you want to call in. We're going to get to Rex Tillerson in the fun half. We're going to get to Russian pipeline politics, which I actually think is kind of the smartest way to think about the Russia angle. Tom Perez might be challenging Keith Ellison. Get into that. And we've got a lot of sound. We've got Bernie doing his thing. We've got Reince Priebus doing his thing. And we are going to go back down memory lane with the very arrogant, profoundly incompetent Carly Fiorina, the woman Donald Trump. She might be back. Fresh Two Dope Boys dropping today. We talk about the fire at the warehouse in Oakland and how arts culture is impacted by inequality. And we also talk about an interesting brand controversy in Japan and a whole bunch more. Subscribe today if you haven't already. The number two, Dope Boys in a Podcast on Stitcher or iTunes. Become a member of the Majority Report today. There's a link where you can buy the Majority Report membership for a friend that's in the blog post. And there's also a direct link to cut and paste in the show notes. There's also, you can check out our sponsor page, Majority Report Kickback. If you're going to use any of those services, use our link. Check out my website. Just went up, MichaelJamalBrooks.com. I will tell the story of my middle name at some point. See you all in the fun half.